Of our two brothers, Creon honors one with burial, but grants the other none. Eteocles, they say, he buries well, respecting law and justice, gaining him an honored place among the dead below. But as for poor slain Polynices' corpse, he issued all the people orders not to bury it or even weep and moan. Unburied, unlamented, it must lie, exposed, a tasty treat for passing birds. They say that gentle Creon issued that decree for you and me, especially me. In Sophocles' play Antigone, the title character sets up the central conflict right away, the rub between the state on one side and family and religion on the other. How does the playwright, Sophocles, resolve the question of which should win out? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What does this 2,500-year-old classic have to tell us about the relationship between government and individuals today? What does it say about human failings when it comes to leadership? And in the Greek way of thinking, how much control do people have in a world ruled by fate? Our guest is David Mulroy, professor of classics at the UW-Milwaukee, author of The Complete Poetry of Catullus, and more recently translator of Sophocles' play Oedipus Rex. His most recent translation is Antigone, published in 2012 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Well, welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much, Emily, Norman. It's nice to be here again.
Now, last time you talked about Oedipus, and when we get to Antigone here, it's the same kind of family tree. Tell us how Antigone relates to Oedipus and sort of set the stage here for the characters we're going to meet in this incredible play.
Sure. Well, Antigone is Oedipus's daughter, and she has a sister, Ismene, and there are two brothers, Polynices and Eteocles. Now, once Oedipus died, Eteocles and Polynices fought a civil war, and before Oedipus's death, he had actually cursed his sons so that they were, in fighting the civil war, fulfilling this this curse. Polynices, in the civil war, was cast as the rebel. He was expelled from the city and went south and raised an army of allies and came back and attacked his own native city of Thebes, whereas Eteocles stayed in Thebes together with his uncle Creon. They were, in effect, the home team in the civil war. And they won the war, but Polynices and Eteocles killed each other in battle. And afterwards, Creon issued a decree that the hero, Eteocles, the good guy who had stayed at home, would be given an honorable burial. But Polynices' body would have to be left to rot. Everybody went along with that, except for Antigone, who comes across as an idealistic, fiery resistor to tyranny. And that's the note on which the play begins. She's, with great indignation, telling her sister that Polynices has been denied burial by Creon, and they must do something about it. Ismene, the sister, says, "Oh, no, we can't possibly defy the state." And Antigone says, in effect, "Well, I'll do it without you then. I don't need your help. I don't want it." And the play proceeds from there.
Now, Oedipus Rex starts with something wrong. There's something wrong in the state. There's a plague and something has brought it about. Is Antigone starting on the same kind of note, or is the situation more of a purely human problem that's arisen here?
The situation in the beginning is purely human. The gods do take a hand towards the end, but it does differ in that respect in that it poses a perfectly human a conundrum.
The stance of Antigone, where she decides to disobey Creon's order to follow a higher law, would that be about the earliest example we have of civil disobedience?
Yes.
I mean,
in one word, it does fit that paradigm very well, and I can't think of any earlier examples.
So what are the actual issues here? I mean, I mentioned earlier that we have government, which we represented by Creon, who is mm-hmm. kind of the head of state after the demise of Oedipus and his sons. We have him on the one hand issuing this decree. Mm-hmm. Is he the legitimate representation of the government of Thebes here?
Yes. He's represented as a legitimate ruler. He was the eldest surviving kinsman of the ruling family, and nobody challenges his legitimacy. The decree, however, to deny burial is highly controversial. There is no code of laws governing this. But Antigone's perception that this violated basic customs was, valid. So Creon comes across as a legitimate authority who's exceeding the bounds of his authority.
A little of the backstory too, as related to Creon, at least in Oedipus Rex, he is in control at all times of himself.
This is true. Yes,
and certainly at the end of the play, he's the one who says the power was never yours in the first place. He says this to mm-hmm. the broken Oedipus. In this play, suddenly he becomes as inflexible as Oedipus was in Oedipus Rex.
Absolutely. This may also be a very early example of the adage that power corrupts and absolute mm-hmm. power corrupts absolutely. Creon gives in Oedipus Rex a very interesting speech to the effect that he doesn't crave power, that he has all the benefits of power without any of the responsibilities, and he would be ridiculous to think that he would aspire to be a tyrant. And now here he comes across as a tyrant.
And his son points that out to him, that, hey, maybe it would be good to listen to what other
yes.
people think and say, and maybe being omniscient is not the way to go.
That's right. Right. He says being omniscient is best, but the scales hardly ever tilt that way, he says.
And he refers also, is it Haman? The son,
yes, that's right. Haman.
Refers at one point, I think, to popular opinion.
Yes, he does.
Being on the side of Antigone. So it's almost as if there is this, maybe it's overstating it, but it's almost as if there is this argument between tyranny and democracy.
There's that element. Of course, this was written in democratic Athens. And the Athenians never tired of pointing out the dangers of tyranny. And they would respond to that argument very well. Yeah.
What about the fact that Antigone is female? Because there's a few lines where Creon says something about how he doesn't want a woman ruling over
yes.
him. And she makes a few comments about, being a woman.
He says if he loses the argument, he'll become a woman.
Yeah, there's a lot of references that I noticed this time, especially in your translation, that make Antigone's strength here. They make it into something of a feminist play on some level because she's asserting her ability to defy authority even though she's a woman.
Absolutely. Her femininity is an issue. And also, what might not be so apparent to us, her youth and Haman's youth is also an issue. Antigone is just a remarkable character. She is depicted as being just engaged to be married. And this means that she would be about 15 years old. And also the chorus and some of Creon's remarks make it clear that she's quite beautiful, that she turns heads. But she has obviously no interest in these girlish things. Instead, she's the one person in the city who stands up to Creon and isn't afraid of him. So it's a remarkable role. And yes, her femininity is extremely important.
She also makes a remark that struck me as curious about how the fact that a brother can't be replaced, that you can replace a husband, you can have another child, but you can't replace a brother if both your parents are gone.
That's very strange. That's a famous passage. It is very similar to a passage in the history written by Herodotus of the Persian Wars. Herodotus, the father of history, he was a contemporary and probably a friend of Sophocles. And he wrote a long history of the Persian Wars with many stories and digressions. And one of them concerned an incident where the Persian emperor had condemned a man to death together with all of his male relatives for alleged treason. And his wife came to the emperor and begged him for mercy. And so at length, the emperor said, well, you can save any one of your male relatives. And she chose her brother over her husband and her son. And the emperor asked her why, and she gave the same rationale. The brother couldn't be replaced. You can always get another husband, always have another son, but you can't replace a brother. And the emperor was so pleased by her rationality under all of this stress that he also released one of her sons, executed the rest of the family, of course.
But, followed through with his arrangement.
So there's a famous story in Herodotus, and it fits the context of Herodotus very well. It seems really out of place in Antigone's mouth, since she's obviously defended the general principle that kinspeople in general should be buried. And now she turns around and says, if it was my son or my husband, I wouldn't care. It doesn't really fit.
Yeah, it does seem odd.
Well, scholars have speculated that maybe it's an interpolation and it wasn't in the original play. And that somebody stuck it in as a learned allusion. It's a big scholarly debate.
Is there a historical background for the way Shakespeare would draw on, you know, King Richard II or III or something and use parts of history and part fabricated? Did Sophocles have anything in particular that he was drawing on for this story?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is the story is taken from a huge body of myths that were being constantly revised and, you know, enlarged. So he was working with a very fluid tradition. And another complication is that he wrote the Antigone first, even though the story of Oedipus comes later. He wrote Oedipus later as a prequel to Antigone.
Mm-hmm. That's always a little tricky for an artist, isn't it?
Yes, right, right.
Trivial point, why is it sometimes, I noticed in your preface, why is it called the Antigone sometimes?
Oh, well, honestly, I don't know. I mean, it's just the style that the people used it, because it's a famous play. It's not,
an Antigone. Like the Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa. Okay. Yeah,
do we see, I don't think we do in Oedipus, do we, the play that was written later than Antigone. We don't see any really gender strife. Or the young versus old. I mean, if you don't count Tiresias, the old seer who everybody has problems with. But, I mean, you don't see quite the father-daughter conflict or the male-female conflict.
You know, that's very true. That's a good point, and I had not thought of that. But at the end of the play, Oedipus is extremely close to his daughters and seems to favor them over his sons. Just, you don't have to worry about my sons.
They can take care of themselves.
They can take care of themselves.
Who will marry my daughters?
Yeah, and I always eat with my daughters. So, you know, they're intimate. And he's also intimate with Jocasta. I mean,
his wife. Yes.
His wife and mother.
His wife and mother. Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know, it's a tight-knit family.
Very, very tight-knit, yes.
But it's not as if, I mean, Jocasta in Oedipus Rex does question him, of course. He says, you know, what are you so worried about? Uh-huh. She's trying to be the soothing, you know, mother-wife figure.
Yeah.
But that's different
from
this.
The relationship is very amicable until she tries to convince him not to pursue the truth.
And he gets, whereas both with Antigone and Creon's son, there is this younger person.
Yes,
questioning the authority or even the mental
stability.
Competence.
That's
of,
right.
Of the
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is the sense with Antigone that she's almost cultivating a role as a martyr.
Yes.
You know, she says to die attempting that seems glorious, and she doesn't even want to share it with her sister when her sister changes her mind. She seems to want to have this chance to die for the sake of right. What are we meant to think about that in terms of Sophocles' view on it?
I think that that Antigone's character is meant to be perplexing, and that we're meant to have an ambivalent reaction to her. She is heroic and compelling and lovable in so many ways, and yet she does have this other streak of seeking glory and being defiant and even somewhat boastful. I suppose you could make the case that if she had adopted a more conciliatory attitude toward Creon, he might have changed his mind sooner.
And then you wouldn't have much of a play.
You wouldn't have much of a play.
That's the problem. I mean, people do have to be unreasonable in order somehow in order to generate the conflict almost always, don't they?
Right. But it seems to me, there's a tender scene toward the end between Ismene and Antigone where Antigone makes a snide remark to Ismene about guarding Creon's interests. And she says, "Why do you have to be hurtful?" And Antigone draws back and says, "Yes, that's right. I only hurt myself and I hurt you."
Right.
And they reflect that they had disagreed. And Ismene said, "Some people sided with me and others with you." So they agree to disagree. And their disagreement was whether Antigone's whole effort was desirable or not, whether she should have done what she did do. And they can't really resolve that disagreement. And I think it's the same. I think that's the reaction that the audience is supposed to have to see what a difficult issue it is, whether you approve of the kind of martyrdom and heroism that Antigone stands for, or on the other hand, is Ismene really the voice of reason and goodness?
And Ismene says a hopeless quest should not be made at all.
Yes.
You know, in other words, she knows it's not going to work. So she says, you know, what's the point of dying if it isn't going to be successful?
You can make an awfully good case for Ismene.
Reminds me of Socrates, dying to make a point. And everybody's saying, well, this is totally unnecessary. You don't have to do that. But he wants to make a point.
Well, right, and you tend to admire Socrates for doing that. Of course, in his case, he was quite old, and he
a martyr's a martyr. Any age, if you've got the urge.
And Antigone does spend a lot of time before her death talking about how she's never been married, never had a child, never gotten to have the sort of fullness of life. So there is more tragedy in her decision. Her outspokenness when she points out her uncle Creon tells her that her actions are foolish. She says, "Maybe a fool is defining foolishness."
Oh, yes, that's
right. That's pretty outspoken.
Yes, I thought so. I think that's one of the
best
lines.
Takes one to know one kind of thing.
She does have quite a tongue on
her. She does indeed. That's right.
What is the significance, when we come right down to it, of the unburied dead? Is this a religious matter as well as a family matter that causes her to make it such an issue?
A religious matter in a very broad sense. It's a big theme in Greek literature. I'm sure you recall in Homer's Iliad, the issue of Achilles permitting his enemy Hector to be buried becomes pivotal. I think for the Greeks, it was a symbol of a civilization which in their minds was really intertwined with religion. I mean, the civilization was living the way the gods approve. People sometimes will say the issue is that Polyneices' corpse or his soul would have to wander on the one side of the river Styx for 100 years if he wasn't buried. And I don't think the Greeks actually took religious doctrines like that very literally. Everywhere in Greek literature you see mixed feelings about what happens to you when you die and whether there's any afterlife at all. It's not that they have a set of doctrines, but they have a very strong instinct that burying the dead is a kind of a litmus test of humanity and civilization.
Well, then for Creon to make the decision not to bury his nephew, because Polyneices is his nephew, right? I mean, when he makes the decision not to bury him, I suppose, is that to send a lesson to any future rebels? And would the general public have found that a sort of abominable decision on Creon's part?
I think they would have found it, as they're depicted in the play. They disagree with it, but they go along with it because he's the tyrant, and they're afraid to express their opposition. But I don't think that's really the central issue in the play. I mean, everybody knows that Creon is wrong. I think the philosopher Hegel was the first person to suggest this interpretation that the play represents the conflict of the family versus the state. And his idea was that both sides have a certain amount of righteousness on their side. But that's not really true. Creon is wrong from the outset. Everybody knows he's wrong. And at the end of the play, Creon himself realizes he's mm-hmm. wrong. So it isn't really a tragic conflict. It could have been resolved the moment that somebody made Creon yeah. listen to reason. The real conflict in my mind is between Antigone and Ismene. That's the conflict that's harder to resolve.
The conflict of what do you do if you know something is wrong? Do you stand up for it and become a martyr, or do you put up with it and live?
Exactly so, yeah.
And so what kind of value do we put on Ismene then? What does she represent in this dialogue, this debate?
Well, she represents a certain kind of truth, I would say. She represents a pragmatic voice that which is good should be beneficial. By just biding your time, you would have allowed the situation to resolve itself, as opposed to the kind of goodness that Antigone represents, which is more heroic and maybe sets an example for the ages. But its immediate effects are disastrous.
Well, now, how would biding one's time take care of the situation in this case other than the natural process of having the buzzards resolve the issue?
Well, as it turns out, Tiresias, the blind prophet, reads the omens and determines that the gods are very unhappy with this decree and tells Creon that he has got to liberate Antigone and bury Polynices or else he'll suffer disasters in his own family. And Creon listens to Tiresias with some reluctance and then goes and buries Polynices. But he gets to Antigone too late.
Yeah, somebody points out that wisdom came too late for him.
Wisdom comes a little late.
Well, we're going to talk more about the play Antigone when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest David Mulroy. He's the translator, quite recently, of Sophocles' play Antigone, published this year, in fact, by the University of Wisconsin Press. And as long as I mentioned not too long ago, the fate word, which seems so big a part of the prequel to this play, Oedipus Rex, what part does it play in this drama?
Well, it plays less of a part in this drama. It does seem that Creon is the character who's crushed at the end because he decides to liberate Antigone too late, and when he arrives, she has hanged herself, and meanwhile, her son has shown up in her prison. And finding her dead is in a distraught state when Creon arrives and the son, Haman, lunges at him, his own father, with a sword and misses. He spits in his father's face, which is unique in Greek tragedy as far as I know, and then kills himself. Meanwhile, back at the palace, Creon's wife, Haman's mother, hears that Haman has killed himself and she kills herself. So Creon is having an absolutely horrible day.
And the curse is coming true that Tiresias mentioned.
The curse or just a prediction that if you don't do this, that this will happen.
Yeah, right. But Tiresias suggested that Creon had time to undo it. It wasn't that it wasn't the Oedipus-like oracle saying that you are going to do this or you're going to suffer that. It was, if you don't. It was a conditional prophecy. And Creon failed to act in time. So it does suggest a contingent view of fate rather than an absolute one. And there's a very curious thing that goes on there. Tiresias tells Creon to liberate the maiden and bury Polynices in that order. And Creon says, I'm going to set the maiden free. and rushes off. But the first thing he does is bury Polynices and burn his corpse. And then he goes to the dungeon cell. And nobody in the play comments on that fact, but it seems a necessary inference that if he had gone to Antigone's prison cell first, it would have been in time.
Tend with the living first and then worry about the dead.
Yeah, right,
that
right.
is curious.
And
then
the two young corpses there, that when Antigone hangs herself and then Haman stabs himself and then there's blood from him that gets on her. It has a kind of Romeo and Juliet feel to
indeed.
It with these two young lovers that are dead and the parents are left to grieve.
Yes, right. I think it's generally assumed that that's where Shakespeare got the idea.
Something of that.
Yeah.
And what part does the chorus play in this drama? Anything different from in other Greek dramas?
Well,
or those
as in Oedipus, they are a chorus of leading citizens. In this case, their age is somewhat emphasized, and they're a good foil for Antigone. I mentioned Antigone's youth and her femininity. There she is standing up to Creon and saying things like, maybe a fool is defining foolishness. She refers to the chorus as tail-wagging hypocrites.
And this is a chorus of 50?
Yes. I'm sorry. It's 15 or so. 50 was the standard size for a chorus performing as a chorus in competition. But the chorus that accompanied the tragedy was between 12 and 15.
And both male and female?
No. All the participants were male. And it's an open question whether women even attended the theater.
Hmm. Well, yeah, they might have gotten ideas from Antigone.
Yes, that's right.
Well,
Sophocles
is also an actor. Did he participate in this?
He was indeed. He had a long career in the theater. And one of his first starring roles as an actor was portraying Nausicaa, the princess who helps Odysseus get home. He was considered a musical sort of prodigy, a dancer, singer, and also a composer.
It's pretty amazing. One of the lines we use to things that we still say today is "Don't kill the messenger." Mm-hmm. And in this play, there are several instances where the messenger is terrified to tell Creon the news because he may be punished for bringing bad news.
That's
standard practice?
The frightened messenger is a pretty original creation, as far as I know, in this play. Messengers in general are a standard feature of Greek tragedy. In Greek tragedy, the visual quality of Greek tragedy was not very good. It was hard to represent things visually on stage, and the actors wore masks, so you couldn't use facial expressions. And these are outdoor amphitheaters and natural lighting with as many as 15,000 people. But the sound was excellent. And so the result is that if you want something really exciting to happen, you have it happen off stage. And then you have a breathless messenger run onto the stage and give a gloriously detailed description of what's happened.
So it's in a way, you'd think messenger, that would be a small part, but in fact, they have the most dramatic in terms of conveying a storyline.
Absolutely, yeah. They are standout performers in that way. And there's always a certain amount of irony because often what they're telling is a story of atrocious suffering, and yet they always tell it with great gusto, and they don't omit any of the details.
Well, and in this way, the messenger comes in to say that somebody has covered up the corpse of Polynices.
Yes.
At that point, they don't know it's Antigone, but the messenger is worried that he will be killed, and Creon implies that that may happen,
that
if he doesn't figure out who it is, that he will be killed for having brought that news.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very comedic scene. He comes in saying that he won't say that he's come on nimble foot with hurried speed or something like that. And he's been circling back and forth. And he won't come to the point. And Creon gets quite angry at him. Please, just tell me what you want to say. And he says, well, first I'd like to say I didn't do it, before he tells him what it is. And then Creon tells him to find the guilty party or else. And the messenger goes off and he addresses the audience and says that you don't think you'll see me coming back here again. You know, thank God I'm alive. And he saunters off. And then after a choral song, here he comes back with Antigone. And he's delighted that he's off the hook, although he does say he feels a little bad about Antigone. But in his view, saving his own life is the most important thing.
The names of Oedipus's children, are they mentioned at the end of Oedipus Rex when they come in as the two little girls in particular, or even the sons that he mentions for that matter? Do the names even appear in that context?
I think they are named. I don't believe that the boys are named.
Which is kind of interesting if he wrote that play after this one. It's kind of intriguing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure.
Let me ask you a translation question, because first of all, I would think that it would be quite a daunting task to take a play that is as established as a classic as Antigone is and try a new translation. Mm-hmm. So I guess my first question is, why did you feel the need to attempt it? And then what are some of the special challenges that you run into, the things that just seem untranslatable?
Well, to answer the first question, the remarkable thing to me about Greek tragedies in Greek is how rhythmic and musical and tightly composed they are. The spoken lines consist of six iambic feet. They have 12 syllables, and they hardly ever depart from that formula. And the choral songs are written in stanzas and were meant to be sung to a particular melody. And available translations do various things very well. Often they're aimed at getting the literal meaning of the text, getting every nuance, every word represented. And other times they translate into free verse. And I've always felt that that's not that betrays the spirit of the original. So the challenge I set for myself in Oedipus Rex as well as Antigone is to produce a speech that is a line-by-line accurate translation but has the same tight rhythmic composition, although I use pentameters rather than six iambs. I use 5 and 10-syllable lines.
Is that just more natural to English?
I think it's because it's more natural to English, and as an inflected language, I think Greek has more syllables per thought.
Oh, sure, to add the case endings on.
Because of the case endings instead of word order. I originally used six iambs in my English translation. I had completed most of Oedipus that way. And I started experimenting with pentameters and found that my six iamb lines always sounded relatively padded. And that, by eliminating two syllables, I was usually producing a better line anyway.
But well, with case endings, rhyme would be presumably easier. But did they use rhyme a lot?
No, they didn't use they did not use rhyme. They used alliteration and words echoing each other in all sorts of ways. But no, as you say, with an inflected language, it just doesn't sound right. I guess it's too easy. You know?
What about things that are hard to translate? For example, in some languages where they have two forms of the pronoun you, where you have a formal and informal, and that's difficult to show in English. But this is coming from ancient Greece, long ago. Are there particular concepts, phrases that are just really hard to come up with a good way?
Their interjections are impossible. You realize what an interjection-poor language English is. I mean, we scarcely have any interjections that we can use that aren't vulgar or that don't sound ridiculously obsolete. I mean, nobody says alas, for example.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, yeah. I mean,
they're
either
Greek.
Comic or vulgar, or they're hopelessly obsolete. So I have a few ah-ahs in my translation. And there's one Greek interjection, feu, which is an interjection of distress and indignation. Disgust, I guess, feu. I use that in when Tiresias is warning Creon And Creon is at first not willing to listen to Tiresias, and Tiresias is getting exasperated, and he says in Greek, "Phew, phew." So I just left it there. But I guess that would be the single most untranslatable thing would be the interjections, because Greek has a kind of a wide variety of interjections that are apparently used in relatively elevated speech.
Is there a passage from your translation that you can read for us and just sort of talk a little bit about choices you made in it as an example?
Well, first, for the iambic pentameter, we were talking about the entrance of the nervous soldier. This is what he says. "My lord, I won't begin by claiming that I've come on nimble foot with breathless speed. In fact, I've been extremely hesitant. I'd take a forward step, then circle back. Meanwhile, my soul would mutter things like this: why go where you'll be punished, idiot? Or, hesitating fool, if someone else tells Creon first, you'll be in dire straits." So that's the conversational iambic translation.
Well, and you've made the translation very readable for a modern audience.
And that's actually one of the things I tend to overlook with translations. If you ask, you know, why another translation, the fact is that in English language use changes. And, you know, as you say, we don't use the word alas anymore. You need to update that somehow in order to have the same value for the word.
But it must be hard for some people who are used to a certain translation, just the way for me sometimes if you hear the King James Bible and then you hear a modern version, it's lost some of the poetry or some of the familiar phrasing for certain passages. Do you have some parts where they're so famous from this play with certain words in English that it's kind of hard to give those up?
No, I don't think that they're – I haven't run into that. I mean, I know what you mean, but people don't tend to quote English translations of Sophocles verbatim.
So give us a sense of what the Greek sounds like.
Well, I could do that.
And so this would be a 6-beat line versus five-beat that you're using.
The best thing would be to go right to the beginning where Antigone is addressing Ismene. "O koinon auta delphon Ismenes kara, ar oisthoti zus ton ap oidepu kakon, a poion uka non etizo san telei, udengar ut algenon ut ates gemon, ut aiskron ut atimon estho poion u, to son te kamon uka potego kakon."
So, it's very musical.
Somewhat, yeah. In fact, it's a very difficult line to translate at the very beginning. I was just looking back at my translation. This is a line I struggled with, Emily. It really responds to your question about particular difficulties, because it's an untranslatable line, in fact. It's oi ko non out. Ta delphon is menes kara. It's O common self sister head of Ismene. That's what it says literally.
Say that again.
O common self sister Ismene's head. Now, we have this untranslatable convention in Greek tragedy where instead of referring to somebody by their name, you refer to them as the head of somebody, almost as if you're referring to head of cattle.
And so why is Ismene's – oh, this is Antigone speaking to Ismene.
Yeah.
And she's calling Ismene Ismene's head?
Yes. Hello, Ismene's head.
Which, so what did you do with that in your translation?
I don't think you can translate that. That's right.
Yeah.
And then besides that, she's the mutual or common and something like self-sister or sibling head of Ismene.
She's almost talking
like that,
around.
You can't translate. So I ended up translating Ismene's sister, mine as I am yours. Just emphasizing the mutuality of the relationship, but not attempting to reflect the head of Ismene idiom. So you do lose some idioms, some expressions completely.
We'll look at the ending of Antigone when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is David Mulroy, and we're talking about his recent translation of the ancient Greek play Antigone, where Antigone stands up against her uncle Creon's decree not to bury the corpse of her dead brother. I was wondering if you and Norman, David, could read some dialogue. I love the part where Creon and his son are going back and forth, and it seems kind of an unusual instance in Greek play of one-liners back and forth, like a sort of witty repartee almost.
Yes, sure. That's an excellent idea. Although passages like that are a recurring feature of Greek tragedies, trading lines back and forth. But I think you're right. This is a particularly good example.
Well, set it up for us. Tell us what it is that's happened leading up to this exchange between Haman and his father, Creon.
Haman is engaged to marry Antigone. And now he's heard that Creon has condemned her to death. So he came to try to convince his father to change his mind, and at first attempted to be extremely respectful and suggest that although his father was very wise, et cetera, he might in this particular instance do well to listen to other people. And Creon just gets angrier and angrier at this and assumes that Haman is just blinded by his love for Antigone. So after Haman gives his final well-reasoned plea to Creon, Creon asks whether the chorus says maybe you should listen to him. And Creon says, "Shall men of many years like us be taught the proper way to think by such a boy?" And from that point, the conversation devolves into a shouting match.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. "Shall men of many years like us be taught the proper way to think by such a boy?"
"There's nothing wrong with that. Although I'm young, consider my attainments, not my age."
"Attainments? Reverence for criminals?"
"I never honor people doing wrong."
"But hasn't she succumbed to that disease?"
"Her fellow citizens in Thebes say no."
"Will they tell us what orders I'm to give?"
"Who's talking like an adolescent now?"
"I am the only one who rules this land."
"A city is not the property of one."
"Does not the man in power rule the state?"
"You'd play the part of desert monarch well."
"You're fighting on the woman's side, it seems."
"Well, then you're a woman. I'm concerned for you."
"Will you debate your father, shameless brat?"
"When I observe you acting badly, yes."
"To seek respect for my position's wrong?"
"You seek respect by disrespecting gods."
"How you disgust me, woman's underling."
"At least I don't submit to ugly acts."
"Your every word is on the girl's behalf."
"And yours and mine. And holy ones below."
"You'll never marry her while she's alive."
"Why, then she'll die and end another's life."
"You threaten me? You've gotten very bold."
"In pointing out stupidity, a threat."
You'll rule your stupid rhetoric yourself."
"Since you're my father, I'll not call you mad."
"Don't mince your words with me, you woman slave."
"You like to talk, but never hear a thing."
"Oh, really? Hear me now, and rest assured you'll not enjoy insulting me for long. Bring out the hated creature. Let her die at once before her bridegroom's very eyes."
"That isn't going to happen. Don't suppose that she will die while I stand idly by. You'll never look upon my face again. So move away to your compliant friends."
That's quite an exchange between father and son.
Yes, it is.
And in the original Greek, those insults, like when he calls him a brat and so on, are they pretty? Would it have been pretty strong language in the original Greek?
I stayed pretty true to the spirit of the original Greek, right? Yeah.
I mean, for him to call his father acting like an adolescent, that's pretty strong for and Creon was the ruler at this point.
Yeah, the ruler and the father.
Uh-huh.
Well, Haman clearly loses his temper. For a long time, he was extraordinarily respectful and saying that he would never value any marriage above his father's leadership and et cetera. But the problem is that since people have such great reverence for Creon, they don't like to disagree with him, but he, Haman, can hear what people say. And there is this opinion that, you know, he's doing wrong.
So you could argue that if Creon had listened to his son and been less rigid, less inflexible, that, you know, nothing would have happened as it did, that he fails to listen to his son who had his best interests in mind.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely right, yeah.
And what is the message then that Sophocles is presenting here?
The basic message, and this is true of a lot of Greek literature, is really one of humility and not thinking that you're all wise. The essence of wisdom to the Greeks was self-knowledge, and by that they meant knowledge of and recognition of one's own limitations. And Plato and others make the point that most people have exaggerated notions about their abilities and their merits. And most people think they have more money than they do, and most people think they're better looking than they really are. The era that is almost universal is people think that they're more intelligent or they're wiser than they really are. And that's Creon's failing. He thinks that as an adult, as an older man, as a man instead of a woman, he knows best.
Chronologically,
he won't listen to other people. Yeah.
Chronologically, how does this play fit with Socrates saying, you know, Plato's Socrates, where Socrates says that the wisest person is the one who knows he knows nothing.
He knows nothing. Well, Socrates would be, at the time of this play, just beginning his career as a homespun philosopher, and Plato was not yet born at the time that the play was written. To me, it's remarkable how often you find the adages of Greek philosophy, the things in Plato's writings and Aristotle's writings, forecast in Greek literature.
Does that imply, well, let's talk about Greek literature for just a moment, because when you say literature, that means something written down.
Sure.
And at what point would these plays have been written down?
Well, they were written down for the purpose of the actors learning them.
They were.
Yeah, and there were limited numbers of copies of plays in circulation just for private delectation. They had not yet entered into the period of public libraries. That came after the conquest of Alexander the Great and the growth of the Hellenistic world and these different kingdoms. But books were in circulation. Socrates himself refers to buying to the availability of the works of the philosopher Anaxagoras in the Agora. So
all of these, if you want to call them maxims or philosophical precepts would have been circulated in writing.
Somewhat in writing, but more so orally.
Terms of oral, the oral aspect of this, you say in your preface that you wish you could require readers to read it aloud.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, right. Well, certainly that's the intention of all early Greek literature, that it was assumed, although books existed, that people, when they read, would read aloud, and they would usually be reading to groups. And that was really the essence of Greek education. What you did in school after learning the alphabet was perform poems, which were essentially songs. And then as an adult, your major involvement in the culture of the city-state was performing in choruses of various kinds. Plato says a person who can't perform in a chorus isn't educated. So I think there's great wisdom in that.
These plays were actually almost like musicals by our standards, weren't they?
I think so. I think that's exactly the right analogy.
With the choral numbers in some cases were sort of the great hits that people walked away
that's
humming?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And can you say something about Creon coming in singing near the end?
Oh, well, I think it's a very moving part of the play. At the end, Creon comes in carrying the body of his dead son. and it now is completely remorseful and has yet to learn that his wife has also killed herself. And, you know, after cursing him and blaming him for the death of Haemon, he comes on. And so you can tell from the meter that the intention that these portions were meant to be sung to some musical accompaniment. And so those are the portions that I've translated into rhymed stanzas. When Creon enters, in my translation, he's singing the deadly sins of minds that anger blurs. See kinsmen here, the slain, their murderers. My youngest son, what grief my heart endures. You're dead and gone, the folly mine, not yours. And then the choral leader speaking says, your grasp of justice comes a little late. And then Creon resumes his singing. I've learned my lessons painfully. Some god, some overwhelming force struck from above, impelling me to take a harsh, barbaric course. He kicked and overturned my bliss. All human labor comes to this. And then the messenger says, O Lord, the sorrows that you have and have in store. You have a heavy burden now. Within your home, you'll likely witness more. Creon, what greater evil follows evils here? Messenger, your wife has died, that corpse's mother, died in misery from newly opened wounds. And Creon singing, death's unforgiving harbor, why do you keep killing me? Ill herald, tell me true. Although I'm dead, come slaughter me anew. What female victim joins the bloody queue? And goes on like that. The leader of the chorus says, see for yourself, the doors are open now. Creon singing, and evil's here a second one. What further blow has fate in store? Just now these hands release my son, and now I see there's something more. Another corpse comes into view. Mother and son, I weep for you. So, at moments of high emotion, the play becomes, in effect, a musical tragedy.
At the end of Oedipus Rex, Oedipus abdicates.
Mm-hmm.
What is the option for Creon?
That's isn't discussed. In myth, Creon just remained the ruler of Thebes for a number of years, and then the sons of the seven commanders who had attacked Thebes returned, and this time they won. And I think the idea is that Creon was killed in that war, but there's no really standard canonical account of those events. So he just continued ruling.
And what about Ismene, the practical sister? Any account of what happens to her?
No account of what happens
but
to her.
Presumably she stays alive.
Presumably, she'll be okay. She'll adjust to whatever happens, right? No, Creon's last words are that he just wants to die, and the chorus says, well,
better to gain wisdom.
Nothing we can do about that. Yeah, that's right. And then the chorus concludes that wisdom is the or humility is the cornerstone of happiness.
And it says that wisdom comes with growing old. And this written by a 70-year-old playwright.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, now hold on. He was a little younger.
He would have been
Antigone
60
was,
maybe. For this. Yeah.
Right. Right. Middle age.
Pretty old by Greek standards.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, congratulations on your translation.
Well, thank you very much.
An accomplishment. You'll have to come back when you finish your translation of Agamemnon or whatever other play.
I'd be happy to. Right.
David Mulroy has been our guest for this hour. Thanks again for being with us, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.